with Don Bennett, where politics and the economy collide.
And John Lott is here. Lott is an economist, political commentator, and guns rights advocate. He is also the founder and president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. John has a new book out, The War on Guns, Arming Yourself Against Gun Control Lies, which reveals some fascinating facts that I'm going to walk through, and then we're going to ask John about. The first is, that I found fascinating, is that the book explains how the current background check system discriminates against law-abiding blacks and Hispanics, preventing them from being able to own guns. The second fascinating fact is that increased gun ownership by civilians lowers the rate of police officer deaths. Now, we have to definitely ask about that. And that since 1950, only 1% of the mass public shootings in the U.S. have taken place where victims were allowed to defend themselves. And lastly, it explains how gun-free zones actually attract criminals and mass political public shooters. And that's where I want to start today. John, welcome to Financial Mythbusting.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on.
So you've written a lot about almost all these mass shootings occur in gun-free zones. But is that just a coincidence? I mean, do you think that these killers actually seek out places where these victims will be unarmed, or are just more malls and movie theaters these days considered gun-free?
Well, the vast majority of malls and movie theaters allow people to have permanent concealed handguns in them. It's a very small percentage that don't, yet all the attacks seem to be occurring in those places. But look, there's different types of evidence that we have on this. One is just simply the statements from these mass killers when it's available. We don't have this information all the time, but sometimes we do. So, for example, this spring in Detroit, a father was concerned about his son's involvement in ISIS. Had informed the FBI. The FBI put a tap on the phone, and they have a chilling conversation that they recorded where he was explaining his plans to attack one of the largest churches in the Detroit area. And his number one reason for picking this church was that church had banned anybody from having permanent concealed handguns on church property. You look at last year, you have cases like the Charleston church shooting. His first target actually was going to be Charleston College until he had investigated and seen the armed security that they had there. You have, diary from the Batman movie theater shooter that was released last year. In that case, his first target was going to be an airport, but when he checked and saw the amount of armed security, he was concerned that he would be killed before he was able to go and kill many of the victims that he wanted to go after. In that case, there were 7 movie theaters within a 20-minute drive of his apartment. Only one of those movie theaters posted signs banning permanent concealed handguns. That's the one he went to, not the one that was closest to his home or the one that advertised itself prominently as having the largest auditoriums in the state of Colorado. He went to the only one where victims weren't able to defend themselves. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, I didn't say anything. I'm just listening. This is fascinating.
And then, you have other cases, recent cases. You have the Santa Barbara killer there. In that case, if you read his 141-page manifesto, he goes through excruciating detail about trying to pick the right venue to go and attack. His first choice had been spring break. Apparently, spring break in Santa Barbara is kind of like the mecca for spring break for students from the western U.S. But he had gone and done a lot of research, gone to the local library, viewed old local TV station footage of the events in the past, and seen the number of armed police that they had around there. And he said that he wrote down that there was no way he was going to be able to kill all the police before they killed him, so that he wasn't going to be able to go and shoot the students that he wanted to go and shoot. But, I mean, you look at just generally mall shootings. The Omaha, Nebraska mall shooting in 2007, there were 8 enclosed malls in the city there. Only one posted signs banning permanent concealed handguns. It just happened to be the mall that was farthest from the killer's home, yet that's the one he went to. Same type of story for the Kansas City mall shootings, same type of story for the Salt Lake City or Portland, Oregon mall shootings. At some point, one would just think that, you know, this can't be random. Generally, if you live in a state that's a right-to-carry state, you can carry your gun pretty much any place in the state. You know, there may be a few percent of the places that you're banned from being able to go and carry it. And so if these attacks were random, you know, 98-99% of the attacks would be taking place in areas where people were allowed to have guns. Instead, they keep on occurring time after time in those tiny areas within the state where people aren't allowed to defend themselves.
You know, it often seems like the emphasis from Washington is passing a gun law, any law, just so that they can say they've done something. So even if it would have made no difference in whatsoever the most recent tragedy was. So one area where there seems to be some popular support is with increasing national background checks. Are there any reasons not to support this?
Right. Well, I mean, everybody wants to try to keep criminals and bad guys from getting guns. You know, the problem that you have here, as you say, is it'd be nice if the president, who has spoken in favor of this type of law after every single mass public shooting that he's spoken on, would be able to go and point to one of the cases where it would have made a difference, or one of any of the mass public shootings during his administration or years earlier that would have made a difference, because it simply wouldn't have affected anything. He's using these tragedies to push a law that has nothing to do with the attacks that we all want to stop. But, you know, the problem is, these background checks that we have are a complete mess, and it'd be nice if somebody tried to fix them. Take, for example, we often hear that 2.4 million dangerous or prohibited people have been stopped from buying guns because of background checks. That's simply false. What they should say is that there have been 2.4 million initial denials, and there's a huge difference there. I'll just give you a simple example. You may remember the late Senator Ted Kennedy. There were five times where he was stopped from flying on a plane because his name was similar to someone whose name was on the no-fly list. Now, I assume no one would count that. Even the president or Hillary Clinton wouldn't count that as five times we stopped a terrorist from flying.
Right.
But that's essentially the way they're counting them when they talk about this 2.4 million. It's one thing to stop a felon from buying a gun. It's another thing to stop someone simply because they have a name similar to a felon from buying a gun. And the problem is that virtually all, we don't know the exact number, but something around 99% of this 2.4 million were mistakes. Law-abiding citizens who should have been able to buy a gun but were stopped simply because they had a name similar to someone that we wanted to stop. And there's no reason why the government has to make these mistakes. If a private companies do background checks on employees all the time. If they had an error rate that was 100th the error rate that the federal government has in these background checks, they'd be sued out of existence. But there's a simple reason why private companies don't do it, and that is they use more information in conducting the background check. When you buy a gun, you fill out what's called a 4473 form, where you put down your name, your Social Security number, your address, and your birthday. Private companies use all that information when they do a background check. The government, even though it has that information, the only things they use is roughly similar names, so you can have a completely different middle name. Your name can be spelled completely differently. It's just that it has to phonetically sound similar. So you can have like a John B. Smith and a John C. Smith, where Smith is spelled with a Y or an I in the two different cases, and they would come up as flagging that person as having the similar name. And then they just use the birthday. They don't use Social Security numbers or addresses. And as you mentioned, this creates a particular problem for minorities because people tend to have names similar to others in their racial group. Like 40% of Vietnamese in the United States have the same last name. Hispanics have names similar to other Hispanics. Blacks tend to have names similar to other blacks. And so 30% of black males in the United States are legally forbidden from owning a gun because of past criminal history. Who are they most likely to have their names confused with? other law-abiding, good black males who want to buy a gun to protect themselves or their families. And as I say, there's no reason why these mistakes should be going on. I've brought this up to gun control advocates for 15 years, and they have no desire to fix it. The other thing with these background checks is they're not costless.
But why don't why aren't they fixing it? Why don't they have a desire to fix it?
I've come to believe that they view this as a feature almost, in the sense that it stops law-abiding citizens from buying guns. When you this is even clearer when you look at the fees involved here. So when President Obama talks about pushing background checks, and he's doing it from D.C., in D.C., it costs $125 to privately transfer a gun. And, you know, in some states you can do it for $55 in Oregon, for example. But I'll give you one simple example. In 2013, I got a call from some state legislators in Colorado when they were passing the background check on private transfers.
Right.
And I was asked, what amendment would I put up on the bill? And the one I suggested was to put up an amendment that would exempt people below the poverty level from having to pay the new state tax on transferring guns. When they put that up, with the exception of two pro-gun Democrats in the state house, every other Democrat voted against exempting people below the poverty level. And I could give you other examples from Maryland and places where you've had similar amendments not even be allowed to be voted on. And the question is, how many taxes can you think of where Democrats will fight tooth and nail against exempting people below the poverty level from having to pay? And I think, you know, it helps indicate that these people are more concerned about making it costly for law-abiding citizens to buy guns. Particularly, you know, $125 fee in D.C. may not stop you or I or the president from being able to go and buy a gun, but a poor black, law-abiding poor black who lives in a high-crime urban area, $125 effective tax on that may make the difference between whether or not they're legally able to go and defend themselves and their families. And, I think it just makes it clear that they're more concerned about having the tax there than they are about trying to get these background checks through. Because if they fix these two things that we've talked about,
right,
it would greatly diminish the opposition to these laws. It'd be much easier for them to pass it.
Hey, John, we've got a couple minutes left. I want to squeeze in a political question here. Donald Trump says that if Hillary Clinton is elected president, Americans can kiss the Second Amendment goodbye. Hillary says this is nonsense, but that she does want to pass a new restriction on gun ownership. How big of an issue do you think the Second Amendment will play come November? I mean, do you think Trump is actually a reliable Second Amendment supporter?
Well, I mean, all I can say is I think he's right when he's talking about what's at stake here. And it's not that Hillary is going to put up an amendment to the Constitution to remove the Second Amendment, which is what fact-checkers seem to focus on. The point is who gets appointed to the Supreme Court? We've had a couple recent Supreme Court decisions. One struck down Washington, D.C.'s gun ban, for example. They had an outright ban of all handguns and effectively banned other guns being used. You could technically own a long gun, but if you actually put a bullet in the chamber of a rifle, it was a felony punished by 5 years in prison.
Right.
And so the Supreme Court said, look, effectively, no one who lives in D.C. is able to use any type of gun in self-defense. And they said that goes too far, and they struck it down. That was just a 5-4 decision, and the author of that, Antonin Scalia, died earlier this year. So right now, the Supreme Court is very closely divided. Whoever wins the presidency is going to determine whether that precedent stays in place or not. Now, you know, it's not just places like D.C. or Chicago which may enact bans again. You have California, for example. Since 2001, California's quote-unquote safety regulations on handguns have banned the sale of over 1,200 models of handguns. There's literally only a dozen or so models of handguns that can still be sold in the state. And probably within a few years, those will be banned. And so, you know, it's whoever wins the presidency is going to determine whether or not handguns will be effectively banned in California.
John, we've got 18 seconds left. Will you tell everybody where they can get your new book?
Well, it's available most places. I think it's relatively inexpensive at Amazon,
right,
for them to get it there. But and they can go and check out our website at crimeresearch.org.
I love doing a show on a weekend.